Hello, I'm Dawn Durham, and welcome to Patent Pod. We're here at the Pennsylvania Department of Education Conference speaking with Dr. Mark Sundberg. Dr. Sundberg, thank you for being here with us today. We appreciate your time.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Excellent. Thinking about the students in our classrooms, what are the most important considerations in designing effective school-based programs for students with autism?
Well, I'd first begin with looking at a focus on language, along with social behavior. So if we look at all the needs a child might present to us, language permeates all other areas, and it's such a critical component of human development, of child development. And obviously one of the hallmarks of autism is impaired social communication skills. And that's such a major deficit. If you can't communicate with other people, the tendency to figure out other ways to communicate. That is, if you can't ask for what you want or need, negative behaviors can serve that same function. And those negative behaviors often get reinforced, but they have a communicative function. If I want to get a particular toy and I learn to scream to get that toy, screaming is just as good as can I have the toy for the child. And so when you're designing and setting up a program in a classroom, we like to have as much of a language-based environment for a child as possible. That is, language and social skills can permeate a wide variety of other activities, self-care skills, self-help skills, play skills, social interaction with peers, not to mention its role in upcoming academics and so on. So that's a pretty key part. As far as a classroom, probably one of the most difficult things I've found over the years in working in special ed classrooms is teaching staff the necessary skills. That is, there are often skills that they may not have acquired in special education. Special education as a college degree often does not have a lot of specific teaching methodologies, approaches, and so on, and certainly not a whole lot on behavioral psychology or behavior analysis, which has been demonstrated to be a pretty effective approach to working with kids with autism. So part of your program needs to involve some kind of formal staff training and not just a one-day workshop or an August workshop where you're supposed to learn everything that you need to know. There needs to be not only kind of classroom-type training, if that's possible, but hands-on training in terms of monitoring sessions. That is, in working in classrooms, probably the best feedback for staff I find is you know, live with a child. The best way to learn about prompting, fading, shaping, and some of the procedures is to do it live. We can learn about the definitions in a classroom kind of arrangement, which is important. But to be able to do the right thing at the right time in a classroom, should I attend to that or not? Should I reinforce or not? Those are hard skills. So generally we would offer two training tracks for our hands-on staff. One training track was basic behavioral skills, learning about prompting and fading your prompts, how to shape, how to reinforce, and that takes a while to acquire. The second track was about language. Learning about a man and a tact and interverbal in terms of the verbal skills. Learning how to teach some of those particular types of language. The social behavior, social interaction with other kids, learning to man to peers, learning to respond to the mans that a peer might give a child. Those, to me, kind of provide the core elements of what's been demonstrated to be the most effective approach in getting kids to communicate, teaching kids to talk, teaching kids to interact with peers and other kids. The problems children with autism face are complicated and often quite severe. And it means that our training and our services need to kind of be equally complex and commensurate with the needs. And so a simple intervention, unfortunately, is often not going to do it. And that's where the more detailed training can take our kids further, I believe.
So there was something you said there that really resonated with me, and I think it will with the listeners also. You talked a lot about staff skills and the staff needing professional development, but it goes beyond the one-day wonder kind of a training. That involves coaching. As you're saying, one of the huge benefits of that is to be able to do the task with a student, mm-hmm. to be able to feel it, to know when to react and how to react and what to say and what should be my prompting, what should be my cueing. So I think that's it's an important piece that I think sometimes we miss. So I'm glad that you brought that up. Another key piece, you continue to say this, and I'm so glad because it leads me right into my next thought, language. Language is so essential to be able to teach our students, all students, to be able to have effective language skills. And I have a question for you in regards to those teachers who are struggling and have concerns with teaching that complex generative language to students with autism. Where do we go with that? How do we help them with that?
Well, first, much generative language is based on pre-existing skills.
Okay.
And so before you can benefit from some of the things that generative learning ability has, it's important that you have those prerequisite skills. For example, learning incidentally from other children involves a variety of skills. For example, you need to be able to have an effective labeling or tact repertoire. You need to be able to identify things, not everything, but at least an established repertoire that you're able to effectively name things. You're able to respond as a listener, that you're able to have that repertoire that's solid. Generative learning often involves combinations of existing skills, like reading and reading comprehension. So learning incidentally requires that you have a set of skills. Mm. For example, echoic skills. You can hear other kids talk about things they're seeing. You have to have observational skills. You have to have self-listening skills. So if you can build those repertoires, then you're in a better position to learn under novel circumstances, to learn without direct training, without reinforcement. And there's a variety of those in type mm-hmm. skills in language acquisition. They're composites of other repertoires.
So when we think about that that generative language, it really comes from having a repertoire, as you continue to say, these prerequisite skills, these other abilities and these other skill sets to be able to continue to grow and have this incidental learning. Because it really comes from some past experiences mm-hmm. And from knowing the world around you to be able to add and build onto that. Mm-hmm. Am I accurately
yes.
putting that together?
Yeah, well, learning is like a hierarchy where mm-hmm. you know, you're getting into more and more complex skills. Again, you could draw analogies to math skills and the foundation. Skills are so critical that they be fluent, solid. Same is the case with other language skills. In order to get to the point to where learning occurs without direct training, without mm-hmm. reinforcement, that novel and generally more powerful things can happen for a child at that point.
Excellent. I want to jump to secondary age students. When we think about secondary age students, how do you see ABA guided instruction or applied behavior analysis instruction benefiting that age group?
Sure. Well, as we look at the needs of a teenager, some of them may be language, a lot of them may mm-hmm. be life skills kind of things. And one of the issues I think that a lot of us face is that when children reach the age of 12, 13, 14, 15, what should our focus be? And do we continue to do discrete trial or ABA or are there other kinds of methods? And how does behavior analysis kind of fit into that? And there certainly may be a point in time that following a developmental language sequence may not be benefiting the child
okay.
as much as it could, or other things may. And it may be a gradual shift to language training more directly functional for the child, relevant to the things they're doing. It may be pre-vocational kind of things. But the language training and the ABA elements are always valuable throughout all of our lives. That is, we all still need reinforcement, we need some prompts occasionally, and so that methodology can be very valuable for the teenager, regardless of what their specific needs might be. What might not be so valuable is the formal structured teaching arrangement that we find may be essential for early autism intervention. Well, eventually, we shift that to more natural environment training, natural context, and so on. And that may be the case as kids now get up into the teen years, sitting at a table doing standard discrete trial tasks may not be as effective mm-hmm. as doing teaching in natural context. But still what you need are the ABA techniques of when do you prompt, when do you fade mm-hmm. your prompts? How do I get independence? How do I get this child to be spontaneous with their skills? And then how can I provide them with some skills that will be generative for them? That is the ability to talk about how the pieces might fit together may help in an occupation or a vocation that they end up participating in, or their early jobs, cleaning tables. How's the bucket and the water, and how do you wash it? To be able to verbally talk about that may help the person prompt themselves as they're cleaning the table. Make sure you get all the pieces mm-hmm. and such like that.
So it's not that ABA is not relevant once we get to those 12, 13, 14, 15 years of age, but it's that perhaps we need to be thinking about a little bit more organic situations. How do we get them to generate something new? How do we get them to spontaneously do something? Still keeping the ABA concepts and applying those concepts, but it's a matter of perhaps we need to be taking a less formal path than they did when they were little ones.
Yeah, the procedures are going to be different. So if we say in behavioral psychology, we look at two different levels. There's our behavioral analysis, so the analysis of the contingencies that mm-hmm. may be operating, and then there's the application of that analysis to socially significant human problems. And the applications consists of literally hundreds of different procedures, methods, techniques, token economy, response cost, timeout, you know, all kinds of different kinds of teaching methodology. That methodology should shift with the child, but the analysis stays the same. That is, the basic principles that help us understand human behavior and explain human behavior are from birth to death. There's no mm-hmm. difference. Now, how we apply those to teaching procedures is going to be very different for a 3-year-old than a 12-year-old than a college student or a married couple. There may be the same concepts, but the procedures are going to be tailored to their needs.
So it's the principles are the same, the application becomes correct. Different as we progress from birth all the way up through adulthood.
And it has to. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we just can't do the same things that we're doing with a 3-year-old that we might with a teenager.
Sure, because they have different needs
Absolutely.
And are going to continue to have different needs as we
That's
progress.
Right.
Absolutely.
But, you know, within the language, they all still need to mend. They need to ask for the things. But what they ask for at 15 is not going to be the same as 3.
Certainly.
Or how they ask for it or when and so on. So the procedures may need to be tweaked, and they certainly will be. The things that they talk about are not necessarily book and car and dog and shoe and, mm-hmm. and such, but they may be relevant to their job site. They may be relevant to social interaction, dating. There are all kinds of other things they may need to learn the names of or attacked repertoire.
Maybe a little bit more specific to the situation that they're involved in, like
Correct.
A job training
Correct.
Or you know, a schooling setting or something of that nature.
Yeah. And, okay. and for further treatment of that, I'd recommend Pat McGreevy's work in his Essentials for Living assessment tool, which is designed in part for the teenager, designed for individuals that once they kind of max out on a developmental language curriculum that we've mm-hmm. laid out in the VB map, and life skills become more important for the child, then that can be modified in that direction. And Pat provides a number of suggestions, procedures, techniques, methods, and so on. For working with the older child.
And you said it's Pat McGreevy.
Pat McGreevy.
Excellent resource.
Essentials for Living.
Thank you for that resource.
Program.
We appreciate that. I'm going to ask you now to just kind of reflect about on your work over the course of time, if you would for me, and think about the most significant innovations in autism treatments relative to education. Could you name some that you think are, you know, this was groundbreaking, this really made an impact?
Well, and it may not be innovations that we often think of in terms of the high-tech world, mm-hmm. But more innovations in learning and teaching. And I think that Skinner's work on the mand and separating out the mand from the rest of expressive language has been a very powerful contribution and innovation in the sense that most programs for kids with autism may not start with man training, may not include man training, it may be simplistic, or it may not have all the parts to it. The development of the man concept and the application of that has, I believe, had a huge impact. Just take, for example, the issue of asking questions. It's a major generative repertoire that kids acquire. Typically, developing kids acquire mans for information, mm-hmm. And it's a very valuable language builder. What's that? Where's that? And so on. Yet it's always been a very difficult skill for kids with autism to acquire. The innovation of the analysis of that, the development of that, its connection to the motivating operation and the research on the motivating operation, research that showed that motivation is separate from stimulus control, that there are two types of antecedents, that's not well appreciated even today. Certainly in the 70s when we began doing this, it was just not in the literature. There was very little man training. That, I believe that concept has been very helpful to the development of interventions for kids with autism.
And I noticed you went back to that language piece, right? When we're talking about that man to be a Skinner, it came back to that language piece and how valuable and how essential that is. That seems to be the theme as we continue our conversation to bring back to that language.
Well, if we look at human development, just look at the K through 12, what's that all about? Developing language skills. Mm-hmm. We go to school to learn new language skills, reading, writing, arithmetic, math,
all language skills.
So it's primarily language. And that's the subject matter of verbal behavior. Again, what behavior analysis brings to that problem is an analysis of how language works, along with a developmental framework of when things fit in, along with the teaching tools of basic behavioral interventions in ABA. You put those three together, ABA procedures, developmental research and patterns, along with Skinner's analysis of verbal behavior, that combination, I think, has been a very powerful innovation in the development of autism treatment. Again, it's not well appreciated. I mean, there are small pockets around the world, but yet we all kind of wish there would be more.
Well, hopefully we'll grow that. That would be our hope. I so appreciate your insight and your knowledge and your ability to share that with us in a way that we can understand and grasp this concept and continue to build and appreciate. It may not be a high-tech innovation, but it certainly has been a powerful innovation, this analysis of the skills and whatnot. So I so appreciate that. If I can turn just for a minute here, you know, at Patton, we really strive to inspire others to grow educationally and professionally. We want others to say, look, there may be something I need more information about, or this may be an area of weakness for me. I want to go out and find more information. What advice can you share with our listeners and our viewers regarding growing professionally? What would you share with them?
Well, certainly conferences provide us a verbal community, and it's a way that somebody can come and hear other people present on topics and acquire new information, but it's kind of infomercials. It's a 1 hour talk or a 3 hour workshop. And as far as the student goes, though, I think there can be nothing more powerful than what we would call a verbal community. That is, as you're learning in this field, there's a lot of stuff to learn. It's the basic principles, it's basic concepts. It's not only just a full college education, but it's often not so straightforward. I mean, what we're asking, if you're gonna work with kids with autism, you've gotta know a lot of stuff, not just about language and social behavior and human development and teaching. I mean, there's a lot of repertoires and lots yet to be discovered or unknown. And as I was learning behavior analysis, the support from my fellow students in a verbal community, where we could talk about behavior analysis, we could talk about problems, work them through with peers, and establish for yourself a fluent repertoire in behavioral skills. I went to Western Michigan University, and it was a fully behavioral psychology department. And my main professor was Jack Michael. And Jack's whole focus was to teach the students the verbal skills necessary to analyze behavior in any context, to be able to say, I got a kid who, or to be able to say, a husband and wife are having this difficulty, and to be able to use the behavioral concepts to tease that apart. That takes a while to get that repertoire, and there's nothing like a study group. There's nothing like other people that are doing. If you're in isolation, if you're learning everything online, and I don't mean to diss necessarily online classes, but there's a missing piece to that, and that's the verbal repertoire that you acquire by a peer group, by a cohort of others that are trying to understand the same topic. And again, you can get some of that from conferences. You can get some of the knowledge from the literature. And if you don't have access to a verbal community, increasingly online classes are offering verbal communities where people can interact with each other. And I think that that's a key part of learning this, Otherwise, you're going to feel like you're by yourself out there. And am I the only one who sees this?
Or so this is only be this? Happening in me in my classroom. Yeah. That's right. So I'm going to hold on to this term verbal community because that's not one I've heard before. And I kind of like the ring to it, so I might take that. The verbal community of having a place to go and talk and to say, I'm not sure I understand, or I'm thinking about this, I read this, I'm experiencing this. Is anyone else having that same thought or those same experiences? And the power of collaborating and thinking through not just concerns or problems you're having, but new learning and new experiences and new opportunities for you and your students and having that community to talk with. Mm-hmm. I love it. Thank you. Verbal community.
You're
wonderful.
Welcome.
Thank
it's
you so
Skinner's.
Much.
I got
Skinner.
That from verbal
behavior. We'll give it to you anyway. Thank you so much for being here with us today, Dr. Sundberg.
You're
we really
welcome.
Appreciate your opportunity, the opportunity to talk with you, especially here at the Department of Education Conference. It's been a wonderful time to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you to all of you in the field. You truly inspire educational growth in your students every day. A special thank you to John Ragsdale for producing this podcast. We'll see you next time on Patent Pod. We'll be right back.